From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Love, friendship, marriage, and sexuality. With attention to classical Greek culture, those were the topics at a recent conference at the National Humanities Center. They form the basis for the following two discussions on Soundings. This week and next, my guests are scholars from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Princeton, Northwestern, and Stanford Universities. How are classical Greek conceptions of love, gender, and sexuality identifiable? In what ways did these Greek notions relate to issues such as pleasure, marriage, friendship, and sexual stereotypes? How have these concepts evolved from classical antiquity into the modern world? And what's their effect upon our understanding of contemporary sexuality? Some answers and insights this week on Soundings from John Winkler of Stanford University and David Halperin of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, David Halperin worked on a forthcoming book about Plato and the metaphysics of desire. According to John Winkler and David Halperin, sexual images and concepts in ancient Greece constituted a social language that expressed and legislated sexual codes. These codes and mores are available to modern audiences through classical Greek poetry and drama. But in examining the documents of antiquity, scholars are careful to identify stereotypes that can obscure an accurate picture of Greek sexuality and its modern implications. David Halperin from MIT and Jack Winkler from Stanford University, you're at the Humanities Center to participate in a conference on, we've got a lot of wonderful words on the table, love, sexuality, friendship, marriage. Your time period is classical antiquity. Jack, let me begin with you. What misconceptions do we labor under? What wrong notions do we have about Greek sexuality? This is one of the things that will be part of your conference proceedings.
I think the most important misconception is that it's the one we see on portrayals of Greek vases, sort of idealized in cartoons, that mm-hmm. Satyrs are chasing nymphs happily across the greensward, all participating in an Edenic, prelapsarian sort of a frivolity of happy pansexuality, uh-huh. or pan's sexuality. What we need to do instead is to erase those cartoons and get to a modern-day Greek village.
I'm David Halperin.
Why should we go to a Greek village? Why should we go to a Greek village to find out about ancient sexuality?
Because the ancient world was a dirty streeted, clay-potted place, uh-huh. With urine being thrown out of the second stories. And our access to it, our portrayals of it nowadays, have been cleaned up in important ways by the German, English, and American university system, which wants to purify what ancient Greece was, for ideals of education. Uh-huh. I think what's revealing for us is that we tend in Western industrialized societies, post-Puritan societies too, to ignore the extent to which sexual activities and events were extremely well known, uh-huh. The way in which physical organs are publicly portrayed in Mediterranean villages.
Would this be, Jack Winkler, because it was simply people lived on a smaller scale? There was just a greater sense of what? Social intimacy. Is
yes.
that what you're getting at here?
That's much of what I'm getting with. There's also the factor, too, balancing that, mm-hmm. that people bluffed and kept silence about things which we need to make explicit.
Mm-hmm. David Halperin?
Well, I think what Jack's talking about is something that has to do with the limits of explicit mm-hmm. Prescription in the texts of the moralists and the medical people mm-hmm. that we have, because people who study classical Greece and who try to get at the ancient notions of morality and sexuality necessarily place a great deal of reliance on those texts that explicitly state what it is that we all believe.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what Jack is suggesting is that there's something untrustworthy about these texts, because when people in ancient Greece say what we all believe, they're in a particular mode in which they're not necessarily to be trusted. They're
sure.
like guys right. nowadays uh-huh. in the coffee houses in Athens
uh-huh.
telling people how they think the world really works.
Yeah, what we don't know won't hurt us somehow or other. Jack Winkler?
A good example might be the joke in Plato's Symposium, in which Aristophanes is the speaker,
mm-hmm.
and he describes what sexual desire is really like. And he does it through a famous story that people used to be four-armed and four-legged and have a single head with two faces, but that because of their insolence to the gods, they were divided down the middle,
mm-hmm.
so that now we're human bodies with a single face, two arms, and two feet. The genitals were arranged on those bodies so that people desired to be brought back together again to their original round, roly-poly self. This is the origin of uh-huh. like why any of us feels sexual desire for right. a mysterious missing uh-huh. other half, as uh-huh. it were, of ourselves. But the curious thing he says is this, that if you were to ask two people at the height of passion what they most desired, they would say, perhaps, we would like to be built together again by invisible rivets into a single body once more.
Mm-hmm.
And this image that what two people really want is to be a single body again is both true
mm-hmm.
and it's also ridiculous.
Jack Winkler from Stanford and David Halpern from MIT. Our topic is Greek sexuality. You're at the Humanities Center to participate in a conference on notions of love and sexuality, friendship and marriage. Tell me about homosexuality. There are, I would guess, many misconceptions. Generalize for me, Jack Winkler.
One of the most important things to begin with is that the modern word homosexuality, which is a very modern word, doesn't describe the feeling and the principles and the behavior that we can actually find in ancient Greek societies. In the first place, the conceptions that people then have of pursuit and of pleasure are not homosexual, but much more heterosexual, even when two men are involved.
Mm-hmm.
Because the differences between the partners are more important in the way they think and describe what happens than the similarities.
Mm-hmm.
To put it briefly, you might even say there was no such thing as Greek homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
What there was were many and various relations between men mm-hmm. and boys and between women and younger women. Which were always described in what we would call profoundly heterosexual terms.
Mm-hmm. David Halpern.
I think what Jack means by that, in part, is that for the Greeks, every sexual act was, to some extent, a polarizing experience, which separated the two partners who were engaged in it into two different categories, which were unlike one another, an active category and a passive category.
Huh.
The active category, of course, was performed by the person who penetrated his partner, since penetration was thematized by the Greeks as an exercise of power, as an act of domination. And because penetration is somehow thought to be the central polarizing feature of the sexual act, it meant that sexuality took on a very hierarchical function. So I think that what Jack means by heterosexual is the division of labor, you might say,
mm-hmm.
between the partners in an act,
mm-hmm.
Between the aggressive and the recessive function. One consequence of this was that an Athenian male mature citizen would have sexual relations normally
uh-huh.
only with statutory minors, not people who were necessarily younger than he was, not minor in age, but who did not have the same social status that he did, who could not vote, who could not sit in the assembly, who could not function on juries.
Mm-hmm.
And what it meant was that his relations with his sexual partners were always congruent with his power relations with other classes in the society. The only people that he legitimately could take as targets of sexual desire were women, boys, foreigners, and slaves, all people who were in a different all of them people who were in an unequal relation to him vis-a-vis the power structures of the society.
Mm-hmm. Jack Winkler, let me ask you to follow up what David Halperin has just told us. How would people have known these circumstances that David has described? What about that?
Some of those are certainly written down in public laws mm-hmm. that could be discussed by orators, and that's how we know about
uh-huh.
them. Others were part of the large unwritten law of the culture, which never needs to get written down because everyone knows what it is.
I see.
In Athens, we have the peculiar situation that some people's social status is completely available. For instance, all women who have any propriety wear veils when they appear in public. If they are selling fish or vegetables in the marketplace and not wearing a veil, that means either they're too poor to care about their citizen rights, or they're not citizens, or they are prostitutes on the side and want everyone to know it.
Mm-hmm.
There are also the areas of ambiguity. Since citizen males and non-citizen males of the same age dressed alike, it could be quite hard to tell who was whom.
David Halperin from MIT and Jack Winkler from Stanford, we're talking about notions of Greek sexuality. Let's do some comparative discussing of this topic. Today we use words like unnatural or promiscuous. Those words have been used to describe Greek conceptions and practices of sex. Why is this? Are we putting a bum rap on the Greeks, or is this expressing our own hang-ups? How would you respond to that, Jack Winkler?
Unnatural is now one of the strongest words we can use to express our displeasure, our distaste, our disapproval mm-hmm. With sexual behaviors. In ancient Greek texts, the phrase unnatural is used a lot, but it usually has a much weaker legislative force. For Plato, unnatural sexual acts are discouraged in the ideal state, but only discouraged because they're so tempting mm-hmm. and so available. But the weakness, as I was saying, of the concept of unnatural then is such that sodomy and taking warm baths can be equally classed as unnatural,
uh-huh.
something a real man doesn't do.
Are we talking about the spread of disease? Is that what you mean when you talk about warm baths? What do you have in mind? Why would that be viewed as an unnatural thing to do?
Because real men are inured to physical suffering
uh-huh.
and don't give in to weakness uh-huh. or any displays of weakness. Taking a warm bath is a soft, lazy, effeminate thing to do.
A luxurious thing.
Yeah. Therefore, it's contrary to the real nature of the male.
So we had the Marlborough man even back in classical Greece. David Halperin?
I want to fasten on your use of effeminate. I take it that the Greeks had a firm notion of effeminacy, that they had very clear notions of what were masculine and feminine styles. But I also take it that those notions don't exactly align with our own notions of what is masculine and what is feminine. The notion about the example of taking warm baths strikes me as a great example, because we would think of someone as masculine who was a football player and had lots of girlfriends and took lots of showers and had a sports car and could have as many pleasures in life as he wanted. But you're saying that that sort of man would be effeminate from a Greek point of view.
Absolutely. This is the great result of Michel Foucault's Histoire de Sexualité. The way he has traced in volume 2 of that series, the 4th century before the Common Era, notions of masculine morality and how it's lived out in practice. And this returns us, if you like, to the example of the modern Greek village, that the plainer agricultural life, the ideals of the what we would call the cowboy,
mm-hmm.
The hard man, is not the man who gives in to every temptation, who enjoys every luxury, but rather the man who carefully administers his property and his body to minimize the giving in to luxuries.
Mm-hmm. David Halperin?
What that tells me is that the Greeks set great stock by masculinity. they wanted very badly to discriminate a masculine style from a feminine style.
Why would this be important, in the same sense that it's important to us today to express a sexual identity?
I don't know if it's a sexual identity. What strikes me is that the Greeks wanted just as badly as we do to differentiate between the styles of the two genders, to polarize the two genders, and show that they were very unlike and did not mix. But they drew the line between masculinity and femininity across completely different territory than we do, and yet they still drew it, and they drew it very clearly.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to the first of two discussions about love and sexuality in ancient Greek culture. The Soundings panelists are two scholars of classical literature, John Winkler of Stanford University and David Halperin of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, David Halperin worked on a forthcoming book about Plato and the metaphysics of desire. How did the ancient Greeks think about love and gender? How have these conceptions come to us in the modern world? And how do they affect our understanding of contemporary sexuality? According to John Winkler and David Halperin, the ancient Greek world was not a libidinal golden age, an Eden of erotic freedom. Instead, sexuality in antiquity was a carefully constructed social language that legislated sexual codes, beliefs, and practices. Here is John Winkler.
I think the fundamental thing to say is that hierarchy is first of all a social hierarchy understood in pre-modern terms. There's not a nation state and a government which gives everyone their citizen identity. Mm-hmm. There is a much more face-to-face establishment of personal and social authority. And the society is so deeply competitive, so agonistic, that men must have masculine allies in order to defend their property. It's something like the old frontier days, the Wild West, before you have police and an organizing state.
So it would be only logical that this would extend to the domain of sexuality. David Halperin?
The other, I would add to that, that in talking about hierarchy, we're talking always from a masculine point of view, in the sense that the people who have options, who have choices to make, who control their lives, are always males. It's not the case that women, that one can speak of men and women having sexual choices or a range of sexual objects. We have a male-dominated society which determines the range of choice that both males and females in that society will have. So that the very imposition of hierarchy is itself a consequence of the Greek tendency to conceptualize sexuality always from the male point of view, having to do with the power relations between men and others.
Jack Winkler?
I'd like to add a qualification to that, which is that the Greeks' tendency to conceptualize sexuality from a hierarchical and male point of view is only what we have in our public texts. And in, to a large extent, this is one of those public bluffs, one of those well-known lies that everyone lived by. I'm thinking in particular, as evidence for this, information my sister gives me from a village in Mexico where she's lived as an anthropologist, and from many books I've read about similarly pre-industrial, highly sex-polarized societies in which women are meant to keep in the house, in which men are meant to be the only public representative of the household's interests. But in fact, if you are a woman and can get inside the house and talk to women, they have a large network and a very effective set of practices for circumventing their own husband's authority.
Would you say, Jack Winkler, that a word like, was there a word like feminism in classical Greece? Were there ideas that would correspond to our modern, are there analogies to the sorts of things that go on today? How did they express themselves?
There are fascinating analogies. There's two. First of all, take the inauthentic one. In drag shows in ancient Greece, in ancient comedies like Lysistrata, in which men dressed up as women for an almost entirely male audience and said things like, blankety-blank these men, We'll not put up with it anymore.
Right.
We're going to have a revolt, a political and private sexual revolt against male domination.
Uh-huh.
That was a drag show. That was a male text, a male performance.
Uh-huh.
Behind the scenes, something that our texts give us only hints of, it seems that there was also a great deal of women's feminism, but not of the sort that the modern society would be much interested in. This is the kind of feminism at which women know that the mother-daughter connection, the connections between aunts and nieces and sisters, is more important to them than any of the little boys' games that men play in public. And this is an ordinary agricultural household women's knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't this run counter to, help me with these generalities that I'm asking you to qualify and criticize, doesn't this run counter to the idea that the ideal friendship is male? It exists at some, incredible ethereal level that mere women will never appreciate or understand. Jack Winkler, what about it?
Well, that's, yes, another one of those myths you find in the coffee house or in the men's smoker, that men appreciate each other's company and that to consort with women is actually an effeminizing experience.
Mm-hmm.
This is another side of what's called Greek, loosely, homosexuality, that a male-bonded and sort of men's-only value society has no place to speak about the interest in women without feeling ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
What we know from Sappho and from some hints in other texts, though, is that women had the same appreciation of each other and the same joking disregard for what men could contribute to the real business of life.
Mm-hmm. David Halperin, Jack Winkler, our topic is Greek conceptions of sexuality. You're at the Humanities Center to participate in a conference around that topic. Why is this important to a modern audience? You could be self-serving and tell me that you study literature and make your living at this sort of thing. But speak to a general audience. Why is it desirable that we know about these things? David Halperin?
Because sexuality isn't natural. There is no such thing as a natural sexuality.
Uh-huh.
Human beings live in a state of culture as well as in a state of nature, and it's impossible to run a scientific experiment on human beings such that you have a kind of control in which you can allow for culture and figure out what their nature really is like. The only way you can do that is through comparative and historical study. Anthropologists do comparative study. Winkler and I do historical study.
Mm-hmm.
But historical study that is designed in part to tell us something about what the limits and ranges of human nature is,
mm-hmm.
what it permits, what it takes in.
Well, let me, following that, Jack Winkler, who were the sexual outcasts in classical Greece? Today we have we talk about gays, we talk about lesbians, we have various electronic ministers, we have people all over the political spectrum who are excluding and including. What were these circumstances like in classical Greece?
The interesting thing is that some of the names are the same. That is, there was a sexual outlaw category called the kinaidoi, which roughly means faggots.
Mm-hmm.
And this was much discussed and talked about in a society that conventionally and in a straight way allowed relations between men and younger men.
Uh-huh.
So that's why I say homosexuality is not quite the right word. They did have an image of someone we might call gay or not straight,
mm-hmm.
and this was the outrageously effeminate man, the man who had enjoyed and admitted that he liked cozying up to other men.
Yeah. David Halperin?
But by effeminate, you don't mean effeminate on our terms, someone who apes women's manners. You mean effeminate on their terms, someone who is luxurious and isn't a hardy type.
Yes, that is, there's two types of kinaidoi, two types of outrageously effeminate men. Those who, though men, cozy up to other men, and those who, as men, cozy up to a lot of women. The name for this in English might be the heterosexual dandy, the man who cares to comb and pomade his hair, who cares to pluck his eyebrows, who cares to smell nice rather than sweaty, and who enjoys luxurious things and sharing them with many women.
Mm-hmm.
He would be called a faggot in ancient Greece?
He probably wouldn't be called a kinaidos, but he would be shamed and abused in many of the legislative, moral, and medical texts.
Mm-hmm.
This is a bad thing medically, say the doctors, for men to do. It's bad for their health.
Let me ask you this, David Halperin, Jack Winkler. We're talking about Greek conceptions of sex and sexuality. What would the ideal male be like? What would the ideal female be like? Now, maybe I'm excluding some things here that you need to include, but were there such ideals, and in what did they consist? Jack?
Well, you have to, as we've been doing, first distinguish the area you're talking about. If you're talking about men speaking to each other, mm-hmm. they have an ideal of masculinity and of proper behavior for women.
And then there was another pigeonhole for the relations between men and women, or what, men and younger boys and men and young girls?
There'd be other theaters, public theaters of speaking in which a wholly different set of values will come out, such as in the Theater of Dionysus on days of comedy and drag shows.
Would you say, David Halperin, let me ask you to comment, were the Greeks more sophisticated sexually than we are today? Were they do some comparative discussion there for me.
This is hard to say. I would say they were less sophisticated in a sense than we are, because they were much less conscious, self-conscious about the extent to which conventional notions about how you ought to behave actually legislate social roles.
Are we more liberated? That's a word that people love to throw around. Does that apply at all in this conversation?
No, I don't think we're more liberated particularly. We're more liberated in some ways. We're certainly more liberated in the sense that individual human beings in America in the 80s have a much greater range of sexual choice and self-determination.
Huh.
Whether we're psychically more liberated is another question, which I very much doubt.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we're just as much locked into our own notions of sexual decorum as the Greeks were. Our notions and theirs happen to be different. And I think we have one advantage over the Greeks, and that is we have the opportunity of looking at the course of history and seeing how sexual roles have been constructed in different societies over time.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives us a different sense of self-consciousness than the Greeks had,
mm-hmm.
but not perhaps a greater sense of psychic liberation.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the first of two programs about love, sexuality, and gender in ancient Greece. The Soundings panelists were two scholars of classical literature, John Winkler of Stanford University, and David Halperin of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Both John Winkler and David Halperin participated in a recent conference at the National Humanities Center entitled Love, Sexuality, Marriage, and Friendship in Ancient Greece. During a fellowship year at the center, David Halperin worked on a forthcoming book about Plato and the metaphysics of desire. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Love and Sexuality in Ancient Greece, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, another conversation about love and gender in the ancient world. The topics will be women, sexuality, love, and marriage. The Soundings panelists will be Froma Zeitlin of Princeton University and Gene Hagstrom of Northwestern University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for the first of two conversations about love and gender in ancient Greek culture. How are classical Greek conceptions of love and sexuality identifiable? How have these notions evolved? Some answers and insights from scholars from Stanford University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Love Among the Ruins, Part 1, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center, on this station.